And they've just started their desserts, but I'm sure they wouldn't mind being interrupted, and we'll try to expedite things on their behalf as well as ours. The first person I'd like to introduce, and he will say a word or two, he said, is Mike Hadley, who is the new publisher of the Sporting News. As most of you are aware, the Sporting News was sold about 2 years ago to the Times Mirror Company of Los Angeles. Mike Hadley has taken over as publisher. Johnson Spink, the former publisher, is still there as editor and chairman of the board. Mike has the role of publisher and president, I believe it is. Back in the 1940s, he was in the diplomatic service of this country, serving in the embassy in Moscow. 1950s, he came back to St. Louis and was an executive with the Hadley Dean Glass Company. Subsequently, he went to New York City, where he was publisher of the Ladies Home Journal, as well as several outdoor magazines. And for the past 12 years, he's been an executive with the Times Mirror Company. My pleasure to introduce Mike Hadley. Mike, would you come up just a moment?
Thank you very much, Cliff. I'm here because I wanted to meet all of you and to see Cliff because I'm also a Cooperstonian. I've been going there in the summers for the last 30 years, and I'm fortunate to have a little piece of property about 400 yards away from the Hall of Fame. But as I say, I'm here to say hello to Cliff and to meet all of you and to hear Mike Shannon speak. I'm glad that some of you were able to make it out to the Sporting News yesterday, and hope that if you ever come back to St. Louis, that you stop in to see us, because we always welcome guests, and we always make available one of the staff members to guide you through the offices and to see our editors at work, and we want to continue to extend that invitation to you. Again, thank you very much.
We're certainly delighted to have Mike here. We had hoped to have Johnson Spink here also. Johnson's a member of the organization. He is on a trip at this point and was not able to make it, and asked that we express his regrets over missing the meeting. To introduce our featured speaker, and don't leave after the featured speaker, you might miss something very important, including some prizes. Again, we're reversing things a little bit here, but it's primarily for the benefit of all of us, and especially our guest speaker. To introduce our guest speaker, I'm going to present to you Bob Bragg, member of Sabre and sports editor of the Post-Dispatch. Most of the men had an opportunity to meet Bob and listen to him last night when he moderated our excellent program. My pleasure to present Bob Bragg, who will introduce our speaker.
Thank you, Clifford. Mike, he didn't say that Johnson's over there in China photographing everything in sight. Johnson Spink, my wife calls him Joe Kodak. He's got a camera in his hands all the time. To those of you I didn't have the benefit to speak to last night, I'd like to say, as I did then, that I'm not only proud to be a member of Sabre, but also salute this group and re-echo those who were there last night heard Andy High's remark that why did it take so long for this kind of group to be formed? And it's so entirely true. I'm asking questions here today myself. Anybody remember who the first switch hitter was? Anybody know who the history of the few right-handed batters who throw left-handed? I'm not talking about pitchers. Mike, remember how few there are, right? He played with Carl Wallace. At any rate, I also want to apologize for inability to be with you, because I hope all of you will take advantage of the opportunity to go to the St. Louis Sports Hall of Fame at the stadium after the game tonight. They've made arrangements for you. I'd like to be there because there's a few little things that someone who helped put it together, although it was primarily put together by a Cooperstonian, Mike. It's very, very pleasant World Series films. Things on the wall, but such thing as Goose Goslin's striped bat, which he tried to use, and he was thrown out of a ball game because he wouldn't let the bat go. He insisted on using it, so they ran him out. But do have fun at the ballpark, and I hope you see the birdies win. As most certainly the man I'm bringing to you now does. I first knew him when he was Little Abner, as I call him. Little Abner was a young football player, University of Missouri, Dan Devine's first year at Missouri, and he was going to be his quarterback until the Cardinals waved a big hunk of green in front of him. So Dan lost a great quarterback, and football also lost a great quarterback, a guy who could throw and run, so he'd have been excellent. With the Cardinals, he was came up in 62, came up to stay in 64 in what was really a pivotal move by Bing Devine shortly before he was dismissed. And he helped in a sensational stretch drive coupled with the Philly slump by which the Cardinals won. He played in three World Series, at three home runs with the Cardinals, and was instrumental in their winning the second and participating in the third one by his move to third base. And it was interesting that here's a major league situation, a ballpark located, the old ballpark here located four blocks from a public playground park, where in the early October of 1967, earlier, or 66 rather, Joe Schultz, who was later manager at Detroit, was fumbling ground balls to him, and Red Shaney's watching to see whether this right fielder with the great arm could make the move to third base, which was a gaping hole. Here is a bad infield. Naturally, you're playing soccer on it here. Big game in St. Louis. Nobody getting a chance. He's doing it, and he did it so well that the Cardinals felt that they were able to make a deal for an outfielder, and they made the deal for Roger Maris. And with Mike's having moved to third base, this was the final stroke by which the team went on to win that year and also got in the 68 series. How long he would have played, gosh only knows. He was a good clutch right-hand hitter with power, but he suffered a rather exotic disease called glomerular nephritis, which hit everybody like a ton of bricks in the spring training of 70. And that's a loss of protein, right, Mike?
Yes, I'll tell him.
You tell him. All right. You. He had, let me tell you, it was a sad day when the Cardinals' sober-faced doctor told us the story. But he came back to go on the radio, and everybody used to call him Moon Man because he was very much involved in the spirit of the ball club that had a lot of the tradition of the old Gas House Gang. And Mike was right in the midst of it. He's come back to be an announcer who says what he thinks, and what he thinks the players wouldn't always agree, and yet he gets along with them. But he sees something that a player does that is understandable only to one who played the game, he says that. But if he sees something that's stupid, he doesn't quite say it's stupid, but he lets you know that it's wrong and why it's wrong. And I think that's one of his great attributes of following up a play with his explanation. He is a man with a lovely family. How many children, Mike?
Six.
Six, right. And as one son just now bit his hand, he's such a great athlete, having gone to the same high school as Mike, that he was one of the most sought-after football players in the country. And the men that were after him included Missouri, which is a good one, and Dan Devine, who lost the father, was seeking his son, but the son was most smitten by Southern California. Mike put the pressure on him, talking to him. Finally, the young man said, okay, I'll go to Notre Dame. And then Mike said, okay, now you go where you want. I just wanted to see if you'd go where I ask you to. But he's a man who's done a distinguished job, and it's a great pleasure to bring to you a good friend of mine, the old smiling Irishman of the Redbirds and Camo X Radio and all the Bush product. All of them, right? Mike Shannon. Mike?
Thank you, Bob, and thank you all. It's really my pleasure to be here because this is a very distinguished group. You people that sit out there now usually and should have the microphone because of all your knowledge. And I hope you don't pull all that knowledge on me when we get into the question and answer part. I'll tell you a little bit about myself. First, I'll explain the kidney disease that I contracted back in 1970, or prior to that. It was discovered in 1970. It was called idiopathic membranous glomerular nephritis. When a doctor told me I had that, I asked him if, you know, how I got that. Was I drinking the wrong thing? Was I out with the wrong people? Or what is that? And it's really a children's disease. Usually it strikes children 12, 13, and under. But that ended my career for about a year and a half. I did have the opportunity to come back and play, and I decided not to play, and I went into the broadcasting business, and I've been very fortunate to be connected with what I think are the four top organizations in the country: Camo X Radio here in St. Louis, Anheuser-Busch, the St. Louis Cardinals, and baseball. I don't see how you can go wrong when you have that combination, and I don't think that I have. I enjoy the game of baseball. My interest in the game lie a little different than the average fellas. Mine lie with the intangibles of the game. What sparks a guy? What makes a Sandy Koufax be what he was? What makes a Gibson do what he did? A Willie Mays? You know, they had great ability, but there are a lot of people in the big leagues with great ability. But there's always something that prolongs and pushes a guy to do what he does. And of course, that's where my great interests lie in the game. What makes a guy like Billy Martin do what he's done through his career? Those are the things that that really catch my fancy besides the game. I guess one thing that if I had one wish to go back somewhere, it would be to sit down with Abner Doubleday and that general, because those two guys must have been pretty sharp. When you see the guys playing today with the equipment that they have and the fields that they have and everything taken into consideration, they're still throwing guys out at first base by about a half a step. So those two old gentlemen must have had a pretty good idea about what was going on. 100 years have gone past, and they're still doing the same things today that they did 100 years ago. And if you look at the rest of the professional sports business, they have changed many, many, many times. The rules, they've changed numerous things. But baseball is pretty much played today, especially the bases and the lines and so forth, as it was when the general and Abner set it down. I'm not going to talk too long today because I'd like to get into the question and answer period, and I'd like to hear some of your questions, and I have a few questions for some of you ladies and gentlemen here today too. So I'll tell you a little bit about myself, and someone asked if I'd tell the story about the day I caught. I was born and raised here in St. Louis. I attended CBC High School. I went to the University of Missouri on a football scholarship. Frank Broyles was the guy that recruited me down there, and to be recruited by Frank Broyles, I don't know if anyone's ever met him, but he's one of the great salesmen. I mean, he could sell anything. I'll never forget, he came into the living room of our two-story flat down here in South St. Louis, and when he left, my dad would have bought his own house. That's how good a salesman Frank Broyles was. So I went down there on a football scholarship. I always wanted to play baseball. I had an idea that I'd only play for 1 year down there because one of the kids in the backfield on the CBC football team was a fellow named Dick Musial. And I think you're all familiar with his daddy. Yeah, I think he played for the Cardinals for a few years. I think he's got 3,630 hits, if I'm not mistaken. But that's where I first met Stan, through his son, who was a classmate of mine and also on the football team. And then later I played in the same outfield with Stan. In fact, I was his caddy when he first came up. And that was a great thrill of mine. And Stan always kids everyone. He said, well, he knew it was time to retire when he started playing in the big leagues with kids that were playing with his kid in high school. So he hung him up there. That shows you what a great career he had. But I went to the minor leagues. I started in kindergarten. Back then it was D-ball. Went from D to B, B to AA, AA to AAA, AAA to the big leagues, back to AAA, back to the big leagues, back to AAA, back to the big leagues. And one year we moved my wife, myself, dogs, cats, kids, eight different times from the time we left St. Louis and the time we got back here. It was a lot of fun and it was a lot of misery, a lot of good and a lot of bad, as there are in most things. But I finally came, I guess, to the big leagues to stay in 64. As Bob mentioned, played in the World Series against the New York Yankees, and here's a kid playing in his own hometown in the World Series. First time they had a World Series in 18 years, just happened to be my number. And first game I had a two-run homer off of Whitey Ford. So you can imagine the tremendous thrill it was for a youngster that used to drive by on Grand Avenue and say, boy, I'd like to play there sometime. I was extremely fortunate because I came along at a time. For instance, when I came to the big leagues, we had Stan Musial, Kenny Boyer, Kurt Simmons, Bobby Shantz, Bill White, Dick Groat, Carl Sawatsky. I could go on and on. On that ball club, there was about 200 years of experience. And I remember sitting in the clubhouse for about 2 years, and every time I was going to say something, somebody put a towel in my mouth. I learned how to play the game of baseball because I just came along at the right time and I saw some just great players. I was trying to recount one day, I played with or against about 20 some odd people that were wind up in the Hall of Fame. And it just so happened at that particular time in the game, in the early 60s and through the 70s, if you look back, and of course you ladies and gentlemen know, that was one particular span, the 60s and 70s, I think, that really will grace Cooperstown when you think about some of the guys that played during that period. And possibly a little research and you look, maybe between the 60s and the 70s, more people are going to the Hall of Fame out of that 20-year period than possibly any other 20-year period. I don't know, but it'd be kind of interesting. One gentleman asked me to tell you about the story. I came up in 62, went back and so forth, as I told you, came to stay in 64. Playing the series, beat the Yankees. In 65, I played three games. Well, I'll tell you how 65 went. On opening day, we played in Chicago. We played to a 10-10 tie. And as you know, Mr. Wrigley doesn't believe in lights. And I was 0 for 7 that day. And hit the ball pretty good, but I was 0 for 7. We were world champions, opened there, Gibson pitching for us. And as I say, we wound up in a 10-10 tie. Well, back then, if you played to a tie after nine innings, all the records counted, but the game didn't. You had to start the game over. So really, on opening day in 1965, I was 0 for 7, and the damn season hadn't even started. And believe me, it got worse from there on. We played three games up there. I came back to St. Louis. Here we are, world champions, and I wasn't even in right field. Bob Skinner, a friend of mine who will be here, and I'll play golf with him Monday, started in right field. It got worse. By the All-Star break, if I'd have been hitting my weight, I'd have been happy. pardon me. An interesting thing happened, though, in that year. We only had two catchers, and they needed somebody to warm up pitchers. So the bullpen is always a great place to hide. And I was on that borderline that the less they heard of me or knew about me, the better off I was, because if they knew I was around, they'd probably send me out. So I used to go down to the bullpen and warm up pitchers and so forth. Well, one day, we had two guys, two catchers, Bob Uecker and Tim McCarver. Timmy broke his finger, and Uecker was doing the catching. We're playing the Giants, and the first pitch, Dick Schofield, who you'll remember played with the Cardinals, was a big bonus baby with the Cardinals. Swung at the first pitch, fouled it off, and just split Euchre's thumb from knuckle, almost from his palm all the way up. And the pitcher that day was Kurt Simmons, and I had warmed him up in the bullpen. I never will forget, because we had the pinch hitters banquet the night before, and I was out rather late that night with the pinch hitters and all that, celebrating. And I mean, there was no need for me to be in any good shape, because I wasn't going to play anyway, right? I hadn't played in about 2 months. So my biggest job was warming up Simmons. Well, I guarantee you could warm Simmons up with a stool and a golf glove, because, you know, he was truly the old pro. So I'm up in the clubhouse changing my jersey, and Harry Carey's doing the announcing, and I hear him raving as he usually did, and who's going to catch and so forth. Now, the next thing I hear is Red Shaney's, who was the manager, yelling my name up that long staircase we had in St. Louis at Sportsman's Park. Well, I thought he had forgotten my name, to be quite frank with you. But anyway, I got down there, and he said, we need a catcher. He said, will you catch? And I said, yeah, I'll catch, because this would be the first time that I could be certain in my own mind that I could go to the plate three times and he couldn't pinch hit for me. So I said, I finally got him. I said, I'll do it. I'd never caught a game anywhere, not in the Sandlot or the Quarry League, and I started right here in St. Louis in the Quarry League. I never had caught a game. So I went down there and I put on the paraphernalia there of McCarver's and Euchre standing there trying to help me. And so I put the shin guards on. Well, you know, if you've ever seen shin guards, they have little clamps on them where they hook in. Well, it's only common sense if you're going to put these clamps on, you put them on right here where you could buckle them, where you could see how to buckle them. And I did. And I found out that one was wrong when I went to walk, because those buckles caught. So I got down, I switched those things around, and they put the chest protector on me, and there was a big crowd out there that day, I remember. And then Euchre handed me his catching glove, because I didn't have a catcher's mitt. And when he did, about an ounce and a half of his blood poured out of the pocket of that glove. I wasn't too sure about that now. Hitting three times is good, but I don't know if it was that good. But anyway, I was a little frightened when I saw that, and I stepped out of the dugout there, and it's been about 12 or 15 minutes now since the game had been halted, and there was a tremendous roar from the crowd. Not for me, it's just because they knew they were going to see a game that day, you know? They were looking for a catcher. And that frightened me a little more. But when I got to home plate, all my fear left me when I saw the look on that umpire's face. I never will forget it. His name's Billy Williams. He's still umpiring today, and he was a youngster at the time, and he looked at me and he said, have you ever caught? And I said, no. And he said, oh my God. So anyway, but I relaxed him a little bit. I said, Simmons is pitching, so don't worry about it. And that consoled him somewhat. So I took a couple of pitches from Simmons, and then I went out to the mound, and I said, feeling pretty good at the time and a little cocky, I said, well, Kurt, I said, what do you want to use for signs? He said, fingers. So I said, okay, I said, I got four of them right now. I said, I'll be happy if I get out of here with four of them. So we got Schofield out, and then Jesus Alou was the next hitter. And he hit the second pitch into the seats in left field. McCarver has never today let me forget that. It only took me about three pitches to call a home run. But we went along pretty good in that game, and about the fifth or the sixth inning. One other thing happened. Simmons lasted, I don't know, four or five innings, and then Perky came into the game, Bob Perky. And he told me as after he had warmed up, he came in and he sat on the bench, and he said, the first pitch, he said, I'm going to knock a Lou down. I thought that was just great, man. It's the first time I was ever on the good end of getting knocked down. So because he had beat Perky with a home run earlier in the season, and now he dinged Simmons, so he was going to nail it. So he was the first hitter up in the inning, and boy, the first pitch, I'm telling you, it was right there. And the further that Alou went, if you ever remember how Jesus hit, he dived right into the ball. And the further he went in, the further that thing came back, and I mean, he really undressed it. Bat, helmet, everything. And I kind of got a kick out of it, you know, because usually I was on the wrong end of that deal. And he got up and he as you know, especially then, he had spoken broken English, and he said, he got up, he said, "Mino think me gonna get out of the way of that one." And I said, "Mino think you were gonna get out of the way of that one either." But then we went on about another inning or so, and the umpire, Billy Williams again, I turned around, and man, he had the same frightened stare on his face that he'd had before when I first came up, and I couldn't understand it because I hadn't missed any. And he just kind of pointed down to the bullpen. And down in the bullpen, Barney Schultz was warming up. So I reassured him that Red was probably trying to trick Herman Franks, who was the Giant manager at the time. And just about that time, here comes Red out of the dugout and come to the mound, and Grote, I never will forget, Grote got to the mound before Shaney's did, and he said, "You're not going to," he says, "Well, I don't have any choice," and so here they come, here comes Borney. So Borney warmed up a couple of times, and I said to Borney, I didn't ask him what he wanted to use for signs, I didn't fall into that trick again, but I said, "Okay, Borney," I said, "there's no sense in giving signs, because you're going to throw knuckleballs, right?" He said, "No, you have to give signs." I said, "Well, you're only going to throw the knuckleball, right?" He said, "Yeah." I said, "Well, why the hell do we need signs?" "Well, you have to have signs." I said, "Okay." So I go back there. I go, "One, knuckleball. Four, three, knuckleball." Mays was the hitter that, if I'm not, there was, I can't remember whether the bases are loaded. I think the bases may have been loaded, or there was first and second or something. But Mays, I never will forget, he was kind of trying to bait me. He said, "Well, the first pitch was a knuckleball, and he swung and missed it, and I missed it, and went all the way to the screen." So he said, "Man," he said, "you can't see it." He says, "I can't hit it." And he says, "the umpire can't see it. You can't catch it. I can't hit it." Well, old Willie was a pretty quiet gentleman, and I know what he was looking for. He was looking for a fastball. And it didn't matter, because he hit a knuckleball off the screen for a double. And then Jim Ray Hart was the next hitter, and hit a ball someplace, and I never will forget it, because I got the throw in from right field, and Mays was sliding in, and I, you know, being a rather brash and not too intelligent catcher, to say the least, I caught the ball, and I dived right into the sliding spikes of Mays. I got him out, and he left a remembrance for me, threw all the way up my arm with his spikes. But that was a day that I really enjoyed. I got a hit off Kurosaki, who's now in our organization, who was the Japanese left-hander, still pitching. He's pitching at Springfield, if I'm not mistaken. That was 65, 66. I went back to the outfield. They were going to send me out. A guy named Bob Housen had been trying to send me out, and they wouldn't send me out. And so on. I came to the ballpark on June the 30th. I never will forget it. And I went in with the extra men and started hitting, and they ran me out of the cage. Said, "You're playing." I said, "You're crazy." I got back in and started hitting. And so they started throwing bats in there and helmets and so forth. And I did. I went over and I checked the lineup card, and I was playing. I couldn't figure it out. And then I looked and see who was pitching for the Giants. It was Marichal. I figured I was a sacrificial lamb, you know, the day. So I went over for three off one, and we had a day off, and we flew out to the coast. And I was in the lineup again, and I looked to see who was pitching, Drysdale. And then Koufax, and then Osteen. But for some reason, I got hot that month in July, and then we went to, hit a two-run homer off Koufax and beat him in the eighth inning. Boy, I made him mad, too. He changed his pitching to me from then on. That was the worst thing I ever did, was hit that two-run homer off Koufax. And then I hit a triple off Drysdale. I think it's the only hit I ever got off Drysdale. I got two or three hits off Osteen. We went up to the Giants and played them on the 4th of July, a doubleheader. Hit a home run off of Perry, hit a home run off Marichal, and to make a long story short, I was the Major League Player of the Year, of the month for July. Hit over 400. Well, that one month kept me in the big leagues the rest of my career. It's amazing. If you can have it, you can just hang in there for a little while. I just got hot and I hit everything, and that one month kept me around until 1970. And then, as I said, I went into the broadcasting business, and I've been very fortunate to be born, raised, and play my entire career here in St. Louis. I was never good enough that anybody else wanted me, and never bad enough that they could get rid of me. And that's the secret of longevity in the big leagues, to just sneak in and out. But I really enjoy the game. I think baseball is the greatest game in the world. the way it's played, and you know, we have our ups and our downs and the bad parts of our game and so forth, and we go through trends and periods that aren't the best. But I'll tell you, the integrity of this game and the game itself is just unbelievable. You know, when the people that have gone through it and the people that will go through it, it is still one of the greatest games, and we could get in and talk for that for hours and hours, days and days and years and years. I just think it's one of the greatest teachers in the business. You can compare almost everything in baseball to life, or business, family, anything you want. And it has great characteristics, and it builds great characters, and it also ruins weak character. I think it's a phenomenal business, and like I said, there's the good seem to survive, and the bad survive in it also, but it's a great equalizer as far as I'm concerned. When you cross those white lines out there, you got to play before God and everybody, and sooner or later, they'll find out what you're made out of if you stay around long enough. So I'm not going to really carry on much longer, and we'll kind of get to the specifics, and possibly if I can help you, I can tell you that if I'm not mistaken, I am in the record book somewhere. It seems like the great Babe Ruth and I are the only two guys that struck out five consecutive times in the World Series. And hell, if it's good enough for Babe Ruth, it ought to be good enough for some kid in South St. Louis, right? If I could help you and you want to get into some questions and answers, and I've got a couple for you too before we finish. Yes, sir.
I got a question. What do you think of the crybabies in a one-sided game when the winning, the side that is winning, steals bases?
Well, that's another great point about the game. If you don't like what somebody does in this game, there are many, many ways to get even with him and let him know that you're not upset with it. And I don't mind a guy. I don't mind a guy doing anything he wants to do on the field if he wants to pay the price. If he pays the price, more power to him. But like you say, the crybaby, you know, when I was playing, if I found some guy crying, I wanted to see how hard I could make him cry and for how long. And I think the crybaby should be run out of the game. And there are a lot of ways to do that. And I think eventually, and maybe not in one time span, or another, but you know, we go up and down the business, but I think as a whole, this business will always come out on top. Yes, sir.
I'm from the Pacific Coast. Any experiences with the weather in Campbellsville?
Yeah, they're none of them good. I tell you what I did there, and I guess there's only just one or two people. I hit a ball. I was looking for a changeup, and one of those left-handers, McCormick, I think, first inning, bases loaded, threw me a hanging curve, and I hit that ball as hard as any ball I've ever hit. And the guy they just traded to the Cubs,
Henderson,
was playing left field, went back to the fence, and anyway, he caught the ball about 20 feet in from the fence. But he told me the next day that ball was 150 feet. And he's not the kind of guy that exaggerates and would come to tell me. He told me that ball was actually 150 feet beyond the fence. And I can believe it because I hit it so high. And he caught the ball 20 feet in front. It was funny because Brock was on third base and they threw him out at home. Nobody out. Because he had started to trot in because Henderson had gone back to the fence and was watching the ball. And then all of a sudden, he started running back in and he caught it. Well, Brock is on third and he's kind of trotting in. You know when a guy hits a home run. He's got to go back to third. He throws the ball in, and they tag him. He had tagged up and then started back, and the third baseman just tagged him. So it was a double play. I didn't even get a sacrifice fly out of it.
Hey, Mike, tell me about the double call, that famous picture of you, which is won so many prizes.
Right. Yeah, I was telling Mike here earlier, I was playing third base against the Dodgers, and Bill Sudeikis hit a little. I've got all these great records, as you'll see. Bill Sudeikis hit a little fly ball in the shallow center field. The second baseman and third and the shortstop went out for it. They couldn't get it, and the center fielder couldn't get it either. So I had gone from third to cover second. In the meantime, the second base umpire had gone out to the outfield to see if anybody was going to catch it. And Sudeikis had rounded first, come in second. First base umpire, a guy named Ed Bargo, was still umpiring had followed him up to call the play at second. They threw the ball back in. I caught the ball. I tagged Sudeikis. Morgo called him safe. In the meantime, the second base umpire had gone to shallow center field. They'd come back in. He called him out. And as you can add, a little argument for a while there. And to be quite frank with you, I think he was out. I really do think he was out. But if he was out, he was out by about an inch. Because he had dived in there hand first, and I think I just got his, I mean, just got the tip of his fingers as he came in there. But I wouldn't want to bet on it. And, of course, he was out because even though Wardle called him safe, Kibler was the second base umpire, and his ruling stood. But either way, if they had called him safe, I wouldn't argue. Whichever way, it was that close. We did have a fine argument, though.
Mike, could we have some of your insights and your transition from the outfield to third base?
Yeah, what happened? I, that's an interesting story. They came to me and asked me if I'd be willing to go to third base. Well, I'd been around long enough to know they were looking for a left-handed power hitter. And I knew that if I went from the outfield to third base and I didn't make it, there was no way in heck I was going back to right field. But I said yes, and the reason I said yes, because I was a guy, I'd get 10 hits 1 week, and then I'd get one hit the next 10 weeks, okay? But if you ever look at a baseball team, there's 26 of them now. About 20 of them, or 24 of them, have only one third baseman. And a lot of outfielders, got utility infielders, you know, this, but they only have one third baseman. And I was looking for a little of that security, and I was willing to take the chance. It was funny, because everybody I asked told me I couldn't do it. And the last guy I reserved my final question for was Maxville, who was a shortstop, and I asked him if he thought that I could do it, and he said I was crazy. But I did it anyway, and that's the reason I did it. And what helped me is in 65, after I had that horrendous year, I went to winter ball, and I learned how to catch, because I had caught the 4 or 5 games there, and they'd have a third catcher if they needed it. And I remembered that transition, learning how to catch, and I applied that to going over to third base. And it was just fortunate. When you can do those kind of things when you play with good ball players and play on a good team. And that was a good team with good ball players. You know, then we traded for Roger Maris, and I'm interested to see how many of the historians in here know who we traded to the Yankees for Roger Maris. Yeah. Well, that's one of the great trades of all time, which a lot of people don't, you know, they remember Maris coming to the Cardinals, and they say Charlie Smith. But the idea of that thing was, and it shows you how my career went. In 66, I led the outfielders in hitting. I finally made it, because I was a pretty good outfielder. And I out-hit Flood and Brock. And as soon as that happened, they asked me to go to third. So I could see it was going to be a tough career for me all the way around. But that did help the club, because Charlie Smith had something like 33 RBIs the year before, and I don't know how many I had, but I know I had a hell of a lot more than 33. So that's, and Maris came in, and Maris was really a good ball player. He had two great abilities, one defensively, and two, he was the best guy at getting a guy in from third base that I've ever seen. He would simply, I'll tell you how that ball club, it must have happened 50 times. Brock would get on, steal second, Flood would hit a ground ball, and now it'd be one out, man at third, and Maris would be the hitter. And they'd play back. It's short and second, and Maris just simply hit a ground ball to the second baseman. Brock would score, and we'd be leading 1-0. It must have happened 50 times.
How do you compare the young fellows coming up today for fundamentals as compared with the young fellows coming up when you came up?
Well, they don't have the fundamentals because it's the contractual arrangement of the game now. They don't have the minor league people. They have to get these kids here quicker. So consequently, this game has to be learned through experience. Some, very few, 1-2%, have some great knowledge. They are getting better now because the college program is so much better now. The college program at many schools is excellent. And these are the guys that come with some pretty good knowledge of the fundamental. But a kid comes and he plays 2 or 3 years in the minor leagues, and he's in the big leagues. And the only way you learn how to play this game is to play it. There are so many little things that happen out there. I can remember Simmons, you know, he was another Ted. And be the first guy, if I was going to make up a team, he'd be the first guy I'd take. But he was on second base with the bases loaded, nobody out. And the guy hit a little three-hopper down to the first baseman. Well, Ted was on second, and he trotted over to third. Well, Johnny Edwards was a catcher. Well, they couldn't get a double play, so the guy just threw it home. Well, Edwards looked at first, and he saw that he couldn't get the guy running down there, and he looked up, and here's Simmons just golly lollydolling over into third. So Edwards whipped the ball down to third, and they got a force out. Home to third. Well, Simmons had never seen that play before. You know, but that's how you learn the game. You know, he was just kind of watching what was going on as he was running over there, and he got caught with his chains there. So you've got to play this game. And and I think it's getting better because they're teaching them how to play in college now. And of course, they're more acceptable at that level, too, to teach.
What was your feeling about the salaries today, and what do you think it might, what effect is that going to have on the game as far as the future is concerned?
Well, I don't have anything against the salaries in the game. The more these guys can make, the better off for them. I think if it's going to do something for the game, it's going to help it in two ways. Number one, it's going to upgrade the players. And listen, anytime, our business, baseball, is personalities. You know, it's simple. Who do you come out to the ball? Who do you want to see tonight when you come to the ballpark? One guy you want to see.
Brock.
All right, Lou Brock. Okay? Names. That's the name of our game, okay? Pete Rose is going to be out there, too. And just, you know, Rose and Brock are at the same ballpark. Who cares? We make $800,000 a year, right? It will put the franchise out of business that don't have the capital. I don't see anything wrong with that. The only thing I see wrong with some of the weaker franchises being bought out of the business or uncapitalized out of the business, whatever you want to call it, is that the people in those cities will miss Major League Baseball. That's the only bad thing I bet. But who says that it's bad that we only have 24 clubs instead of 26? I don't see anything wrong with that. That's the way our country was founded, on supply and demand. And if they say, well, Steinbrenner, they say, well, he's going to buy it all. Hey, more power to him. But if he's been there twice, and the first time was on the last day of the season, and the next time we had to have another game to get him there. All right, it ain't too out of balance as far as I'm concerned. When a guy goes out and spends millions and millions, and he's got to get there on the last day, and then the next year he's got to get there with a tie and a playoff after the season. So it can't be too out of balance. And the guys that don't want to pay for it, they're going to suffer a little. I mean, it's no different in business. This big company comes down and buys out the Sporting News, right? Happens every day. You know, that's great because they're in the business. They're going to make the Sporting News even better with greater facilities. But nobody says that's bad. And it's not bad. That's good. That's good for the business, and it's especially good for the Sporting News. It's the same way with Mr. Steinbrenner. He put the Yankees back on the map. He may put Mrs. Payson and the Payson group out of business up there if they don't do something. But they've been out of business up there before. Yes, sir. Yeah, if you want to take a ride with me down to the river, I'll be more happy. I agree with you. We do have, the umpires today are excellent. And I think that one umpire you'll see is a big black guy. His name is Eric Gray. I think he's got a chance of becoming a really good umpire. And if you want to get out in the corner, I'll tell you. Yeah. Yes, sir.
Mike, I want to say something you're not aware of, that what you have did for black youth and all the youth in St. Louis. Man, I deal with a lot of the youth in St. Louis as a graduate from Tuskegee and also training Stanford University. And I want to say this afternoon, you've been an inspiration to all the youth of this town. I hear many good things about you. They like your broadcasting, only they like you as a man, what you have did to prove what a young man can do if we have courage. You put a lot of effort inspiration and to many of the youth of St. Louis.
Thank you, Mr. Holliday. Since he was so complimentary to me, I'd like to introduce Mr. Holliday. He played with the Black Yankees years and years ago. Stand up. You want to have some fun, sit with guys like him and that cool papa, man. They'll tell you some stories that are hard to believe. And really, there's some great stories about that. Yes, sir. Harden, it was two outs, scoreless ball game, and Harden, I was playing third base, and I moved over to guard the line. And he had a two-hopper through the hole. I missed it by about 3 or 4 feet, just perfect in the hole. Then the next hitter, I don't remember, maybe McAuliffe, but anyway, he had a bad hop single over Javier's head. Took one out and bounced over his head, and then Northrup was the next hitter and hit that line drive in the center field. I don't know whether Kurt would have caught that ball or not, but he played it properly. He slipped. He took the first step in, and most good outfielders, even when the ball's hit over their head, the first step, half a step, is in. And when he went to place that foot and turn, he slipped. But of course, when he slipped, and I was playing third, I had a good angle, and I knew that I was going to have a play at third. Wound up 3-1. Was it 3-1 at the final score?
You hit a home run in the ninth.
Yeah, I had to score. I got more letters off that home run I hit in the ninth inning. Two strikes, two outs in the ninth with nobody on, 3-0. Well, I never will forget the great one, a bartender in Detroit. Had a $1,000 pool. He wrote me the nastiest letter. Could you see this guy in the bar watching that TV counting that $1,000 out? He had, I think it was 59 runs he had, and here I hit that home run with two outs and two strikes, and that was the 60th run, and that little $1,000 just went trickling out of his hand. He wrote me a letter you will not believe. I wrote it back. I asked him, I said, well, if he'd have sent me a telegram or something splitting the 500, I said, that'd have been different. Yes, sir, way back then. All bad. Facing Drysdale. I never could pick the ball up off of Drysdale. And I knew he was getting to the end of his career. And I got two hits off him one night in L.A. That triple I told you about was funny. It was a day game. And he was trying to throw me a curve, and it slipped evidently. And when it slipped, he yelled. I don't know what he yelled, but when he yelled, man, he woke me up. And the ball was up here about when I hit it. Boy, I smacked it off the wall. And I told him the next day, I said, all you had to do is keep your mouth shut out and miss that one, too. But the day he retired, the day he announced his retirement, I went out the next day, man. I was out there early. I couldn't wait to see him because I shook his hand. I was the happiest guy in the league. Kovacs, I hit pretty well. Well, nobody hit him well, but I beat him a couple of games. I never will forget the first game I played against him. I got three hits off of him. And they were all kidding. I was this young kid, all of Sawatsky and all that group we had. They said, shh, don't anybody tell him who's pitching. We had a good time. That was a great bunch of people that I came up with, all those guys. They were really phenomenal. Do you have a question there? What kind of cap is that? Cubs? Not Cubs. That's an old one.
Cardinals.
That's an old Cardinal cap? Before I got there, I'll tell you that. You have a question?
How many times did you get hit by the ball?
Too many times. I don't know. I got hit, I don't know, 10 times. You mean while I was hitting? 10, I guess. I don't know. I can tell you the worst time, Maloney hit me. I remember that. Eyebrows, toenails, everything hurt.
Did you get black and blues?
Black and blue.
Purple?
Purple. Got it all, my man.
Mike, the next player, what's the problem with some of the deterioration between players and having
been on both sides? Oh, that's a good question, and I haven't, and it is deteriorating a lot.
Mike, what's the question?
Oh, I'm sorry. The question is the problem between the media and players. it's deteriorating. If I had to put my finger on it, I would have to say that some of the controversy, because you know, coming out of New York or where there's more than two papers in town, when you've got three or four papers, you know, how many stories can you write about one ball game? So consequently, you've got guys looking for things to write about, and I think another consequence of that is that maybe they take things out of context or that they betray something. You know, I read something in the paper this morning, too, and I can't wait to get to the ballpark to talk about something. I read in the paper this morning about Ted Simmons having his cast removed and maybe back sooner. Now, I knew about that, but I had that in confidence, and I didn't use it. But then I read it in the paper this morning. Now, I'm upset about that. I'm upset for two reasons. Number one, the guy that told me in confidence would, number one, doubt me possibly. I know he won't because I know him very well. And he does have the confidence in me. But I'm upset about that because somebody wrote it, and it was not supposed to be written. And I don't know who wrote it because it's in the morning paper, and I think it's a UPI or AP. And I think what happens, Bob, is that, you know, you get two or three different guys or five. You go to New York, you've got six, eight, ten guys trying to write about one ball game, so they're digging for some kind of stories. And I think consequently, too, you've got guys playing today, and they play the game different. They're not, some people in the game today aren't willing to pay the price. And I think it comes from the little leagues and from the parental pressure put on little league ball players. And it's a long theory that I have. But here's what happens. I'll kind of run over it. They play in the little leagues, and the parents put such pressure on these kids. By the time they finally get to the big leagues, and now they can assert their own philosophies. Well, I'll tell you what their philosophy is. Because of all that pressure they sustained through the younger years, they say, well, you get your three hits, and I'll get my three hits, and we'll all be happy. That's my own personal philosophy about some people. And I don't play the game that way, and I don't think the game should be played that way. Only one thing counts, and that's who's got the bacon at the end of the game. That's the only thing that counts. The happiest day I've ever had in baseball, and you know, I hit a home run off Whitey Ford in the World Series in my own hometown and played three Worlds. The happiest I've ever been in my life is in San Francisco, California. A guy wrote a story there. We had cinched the pennant in Houston and had our champagne party, flew all night, got out to San Francisco, had another party, right? Well, this guy wrote the story that if we got to the ballpark that night, we'd be lucky. And if we did get there, Gaylord Perry would probably no-hit us. We got there and Gaylord Perry no-hit us. The next day at noon, we played a noon game, and Ray Washburn pitched a no-hitter against them. First time in the history of the game it's ever happened. When it looked like that club that could just about do it and did do it, said, well, fine, we'll just give this guy something to write about. Let Perry pitch a no-hitter against us, and then the next day Washburn pitched a no-hitter against us. That's the happiest day I've ever had in my life. And I'm telling you, here I am playing third base with two out in the ninth inning and no hits, and you know who's the hitter, right? Gotta be only one guy, Willie Mays. And when Willie Mays hit a ground ball, I guarantee it was always on the left side. I don't think he ever hit a ground ball to the right side in his life. So I'm saying, well, all I got to do is touch it, right? Or let it hit me, anything. And here it is, man, the first pitch. Bang, boom! And I got it. And I said, well, hell, I had it, so it didn't matter. From here on, it's in there. And I must have bounced that thing about 20 feet in front of first base. But Cepeda got it. Now, that's the happiest I've ever been in my life, because here's a guy that was trying to, he was trying to belittle the game, this writer, in my estimation. It's always been a tradition that when you win the pennant, you celebrate, right? So he's taking a cheap shot at the game. That's the way I saw it. You know, well, what kind of garbage is he writing in the front page of the sports section about guys having a party and they'd be lucky if they get there? Well, when we just cinched the pennant, and he ought to have been writing about, you know, whatever he wanted to write about. How does that look when the kid that picks up the paper and says, well, these guys are out? So we were. He's right. We were out celebrating. We had a right to celebrate as far as I'm concerned. But I just didn't, you know, why write something like that? So the next day, see, he wrote for the afternoon paper, and the great thing about that was, can you imagine the story he had to tear up? I told you so. Can you imagine the great I told you so story that he had in his pocket? That's why I was so happy about it. But I think what happens, to get back to that question, Bob, is that some of the writers, and they take these, whatever you want to call them, and so consequently, I think because it's happened that some people lose their credibility, and the press has lost some credibility because of this, because of the competition. Now, I know, I'm in my own mind, I think Bob Bragg could go down to that clubhouse and talk to anybody, because Bob Bragg has earned the right and the credibility to go down there. And I've had some of the young writers who cover us now come up, and I think we have a couple of very good writers here in St. Louis, young kids. And I've had them come to me and ask me about, well, they won't talk to me. I says, well, what makes you think you have the right to be expected to be talked to? I think you have to earn that right. I think you have to put your time in. I realize that there are, that the papers have their job and the ball players have that job, and the guy that doesn't want to talk to the press is not right in my mind, because it's only helping the game. You people want to read about what a guy has to say. You want to hear about what he has to say. And I think that's the way it ought to be. But I still don't think that any player owes me the right to talk to me because I'm in the media or because I was a player. I think that's something that has to be earned, and as I say, and you get credibility. Like yourself, you've been around a long time, and you know a lot of things and have known a lot of things, and you've kept them for years and years because I've read the stories. 3-4 years later, because you knew that it wouldn't hurt anybody or the game when you wrote them. And people respect that about you, and they'll tell you things in confidence today, which gives you a better insight and makes you a better writer. But I don't agree with the guys not talking. But we've got a problem right here, and I'm sure you're aware of it. And there's a lot of people not talking to one particular man here because they figure they took a cheap shot at him. And I don't blame them if they figure it was a cheap shot and it was all hearsay. And I don't know if you know what I'm talking about or not. But I know this has happened because I saw a real good example of it last night. Yes, sir.
Best year in batting average,
and
what was your average, and why did you consider that year
the best? Well, what was my best average, and what was my best year, and why was that my best year? My best years were in 64 and 67 because we were world champions. It didn't matter what I did, you know, if I made a contribution. I think the best year I ever had was in 1968. Not for what I hit, but I had like 26 game-winning RBIs. And that gave me satisfaction. You know, the only satisfaction I got out of the game was having that one-on-one competition. Being up there in the bottom of the ninth and having it on the line, that was gratifying to me. I think my best year was 288 or something like that. It was in 66, but man, we were so down the pole, it didn't matter. I could have hit 588. I just didn't enjoy that. I enjoyed about the game, say we were in the seventh inning and I was playing third base and we were winning 2-0, and I kind of thought the pitcher was getting a little unattentive to his business, and I'd go over there and say, hey, let's go. We only have 6 outs to go, 8 outs, 9 outs to go. Let's go. That's where I got my great satisfaction out of the game. Then after the game, sitting there and knowing that we were the best team and just had gone out and proved that we were the best team. And it's a thing that you can't, it's hard to comprehend, it's hard to understand it if you haven't been able to do it. But I know that good club in 67 and 68, we went on the field, the other team knew we were better, they knew we were going to beat them. If we asserted ourselves early. If you went out there and the other team got on top of you, oh man, they come up about 9 feet because they saw something they couldn't. The only way they could do was win. They expected them to lose anyway, so now they got on top. So those were the things that really, and I think it was 66 and If you want to look at averages, man, don't look at mine, because they're all bad. Yes, sir.
Yeah, what tell us what it was like playing with Gibson in 68.
Playing with Gibson in 68 was the best vacation I ever had. I stood over at third and cheered. I'll tell you a funny story about it. I went over to play third in 67, and, man, I was just trying to knock everything down and, you know, get out of there without getting killed. But and I came with a pretty good year because we won, so we had a good year. 68, I went back over there, and I got where I thought I knew a little bit about playing over there. So one day I went to Gibson. I said, hey, who? I said, anywhere you want me to play? Any particular guy you want me to play different? He said, I don't give a damn where you play. He said, you just be ready when there's a man on first base or first and second with less than two outs. And I thought, well, you know. But I paid attention from then on, and it was amazing how many times there's a man on first with one out or a man on first and second with nobody out, I'd get a one-hopper, double play. A man knew how to pitch, and he knew what he was talking about. Because I paid attention, and about, it must have happened in that month, it must have happened like 15 or 18 times. First pitch, boom, one-hopper right to me, second, first, double play. But that may be one record, and that brings me to my question is, I'd like to know what some of you guys and some of you gals think about the top three or four records in the game that will be almost untouchable. And that may be one of them, Gibson's ERA in 1968. And it could have been even better, too. Well, that's hard to say. A 1.12 ERA, oh, that was phenomenal. But he was as good a competitor as I've ever seen. You go back and check his record. I'd like to see how many ball games he lost in the 7th, 8th, and 9th inning. I bet you could count them on your hands and toe. Because, man, when he got to the 7th and he could smell that bacon, he was some ferocious pitcher. And the greatest game I've ever seen pitch was the first game of the series in 68. And that Detroit club had a good hitting ball club, and they looked like little leaguers. They were so overmatched. And I'm talking about Al Kaline, Cash, Northrop, McCullough. They had some good ball players on that club, some great hitters. And I've never seen major league ball players overmatched more that day than I don't think maybe there ever will be. I mean, he struck out 17, I think. But it's just the way he struck them out. Man, it was 1-2-3 and get it back. But how about some of those records? Yes, sir. I think the attributes of a great manager are two things. Just to manage men. That's the name of the game. You know, I think most managers have, let's say 20 out of 24 are about even. The other four guys probably are a little smarter, know a little bit more about the game. I think the man that knows the rule books the best, knows a lot about the game, is one of the smartest managers ever, is Gene Mock. But he's never got the bacon. So he's doing something wrong. He's probably too smart. I think he's too smart. You understand? He's too smart. I think the great manager is just like any other manager. You know, I'll give you an example. When August A. Bush took over the brewery down here, years ago, one of the guys on the board of director, when they were asking the questions about electing him as the chairman of the board, one guy asked him, he said, well, what makes you think you know all about this business? And he said, there's a lot of things I don't know about this business, but he said, I'll tell you this, I'm going out and I'm going to hire the best guys in this business for the job. Okay. That's what you call management. To be able to get the most out of the most people you can on your ball club. And that doesn't mean keeping them happy. Another thing that's important in this game, baseball players are unsecure. They are unsecure people, okay? And if you can give them security and confidence, that's another thing. You know, even a guy that's Even Pete Rose, who's making $800,000 a year, okay? You say to yourself, well, what kind of security does that? But I tell you what, you let me have Rose for a month, and I can make him insecure for you. And that probably would be the one most difficult man in the game of baseball to make insecure. But I can do it to him. Real easy. It's easy. So that's it. You've got to be able to keep your people secure and confident. And, you know, one guy you got to pat on the back, the other guy you got to kick in the pants. The other guy you got to pay any attention to him, the other guy you got to pamper him. You know, shiny shoes, go over to him every day, how's everything? Your wife all right? Send some champagne over to his house or whatever, you know, case of Budweiser, what? And the other guy, you got to make him mean and mad every time he comes out there. You got to say something nasty to him to get him mad so he goes out and beats somebody over the head. Gibson was a great motivator of himself. Man, he came to the ballpark when he was going to pitch. Nobody talked to him. I wouldn't talk to him. He'd bite your head off because he wanted to be mad. See, he's a nice man. And he got the reputation of being a snarly old son of a you-know-what, right? And he got a reputation of being a bigot, or not a bigot, the word I'm looking for, a militant, okay? He was neither of those. He was a nice man. He is a nice man. He's got a big heart. But the way he motivated himself was when he came out there, he was a snarly. He didn't talk to anybody. He didn't like anybody. Because if you like somebody, how are you going to throw one in their ribs? Really? You know, it's pretty difficult. You know, if you hear these stories about he'd knock his grandma down. Well, if his grandma was up there hitting and needed knocking down, she needed knocking down, right? It doesn't matter who they are. But that's how Gibson motivated himself. And the great ball clubs have managers that know how to have ball players motivate the other ball players. All you need is about two or three guys on your team, and they'll take care of your ball club for you, and they'll take care of all the good and the bad on your club. That's the secret of a good ball club. Every good ball club polices themselves and motivates themselves, the players. See, if one of your peers comes over to you and says, hey man, what's going on out there? Let's shake it up here, right? Well, he's got 24 guys know that he's not doing the job, and they'll run him out. That's the good clubs, and those are the good managers that know how to motivate and police a ball club without ever doing it themselves. Go ahead. Oh, the good managers? Stinger was a great philosopher. You know, all that Stingalese, he tricked so many people with that. You know, and all the guys in the press that covered him, they knew what he was doing. You talk to Casey someday, and then after he started this and found out that it worked so well, well, he got to where it almost lost him, too. You know, he got to where he didn't know where to separate it himself. Like Minnesota Fats is a friend of mine. You listen to him talk. Man, he believes what he's saying. Biggest prevaricator ever lived. But he's actually believing it. Casey was fantastic. You know, Maris told me, he's in Yankee Stadium, the bases are lowered, he's in the batter's box, and Stinger called time. And he called him back and says, come here, Roger. And he says, now look, when this guy winds up, he says, as soon as he winds up, you start saying, Butcher Boy. You say, Butcher Boy, Butcher Boy, Butcher Boy, till that thing comes and then smack it. And Roger thought, man, this old man's, he's flipped, he's gone. But you know what he's done right now? He figured Maris was a little nervous, okay? He was young at the time, maybe. The game was on the line. Maris is no longer thinking about how nervous he is. He's thinking about how crazy Stingle is. Butcher Boy. So what the hell is he talking about? Butcher. So he took all the nervousness out. Maris got a base hit. He come out. That's the way to go, Roger. Just remember that. Butcher Boy. Butcher Boy. So, yeah, go ahead. Okay. Right. What's that? Okay. Right. Yeah, and that's also lifetime. There ain't nobody going to get his lifetime slugging average.
Mm-hmm. physical level of deep understanding. And I would suggest that that is a fundamental career in existence.
Yeah, I agree with that, Dennis. I think Babe Ruth's got the greatest, the untouchable hitting record, that slugging percentage lifetime. That's unbelievable. 690, I believe it is. And, of course, like you say, what was it, 500 and some odd?
56 games by...
Yeah, no, they say that 56 games, but I think that that's reachable.
Derek's 2,130.
Consecutive games, there'll be somebody that's crazy enough to break that.
Jack Wilson's 190. Wilson's 190 RBI.
What's that?
Heck, Wilson's 190 RBIs.
190 RBIs is tough, too, but I'll tell you, guys getting close to it, and somebody's going to get in that cup park one of these days, yeah. Like Kingman. You know, I told John Hall, one of the great writers out in L.A., I said, listen, Kingman could hit 80 home runs there someday. He laughed at me. But someday, somebody's going to hit 70 home runs, 75, 80 home runs in Wrigley Field. They catch all that wind blowing out, and the guy that hits to the... What do you think Cepeda hit there if he played there all his life? The guy that hit the ball up the alleys. I'm telling you, that's a great place to play, man. That ball jumps out of that park.
One thing, man, the Cubs only hit 72 home runs last year.
Well, the Cubs. Cubs haven't won since Abner was watching games, too, you know. Go ahead.
Some days are really filled, the wind blows in.
Yeah, I understand.
Lots of days.
I understand that, but you're going to catch a line drive hitter. But when the wind blows in, it doesn't hurt a line drive. It helps a line drive. I'll tell you why. If the guy hits the ball in the alleys out there, and the wind's blowing in, he hits a line drive, it keeps the ball up, but it still has enough velocity to get to that little 386 or whatever that thing is out there.
368,
right.
3 weeks ago, the wind was blowing in, and Kingman still got two homers. He was the only one.
Right. You know, Kingman, he's so strong, but he's not the guy. The guy that's going to do it is going to be a line drive hitter. You know, look what the Banks did in that park. We used to kid Banks all the time about, you know, hitting all those home runs in the first and the second row. Hey, listen, you know, the guy says, well, he hit 55 home runs. We had Roger Freed hit 60 home runs or something, or 56 home runs in the minor leagues. I don't give a damn to hit him out here in the park, man. When you hit 56 home runs, that's 56 home runs. Okay. Yes, sir.
I think you've got to include Ty Cobb's lifetime batting average. I mean, if a guy hits 361, in the season, he's had a great year. You do that over a lifetime, next season, right?
Yeah, but somebody got to come along. Somebody will come along and play for 10 years maybe on this AstroTurf.
How about the record? Triple
well, Willie Wilson.
36. Temple had 18 last year. Yeah. As opposed to 20 years.
That young man there. Drysdale, man. He drove me nuts. Drysdale's the toughest guy I ever faced. Yeah. It's amazing. You know, I hit Marichal good. I hit all the good pitchers good because I knew where they were going to throw it. I didn't learn how to hit until it was too late. It took me a long time to learn how to hit. I finally learned how to hit and it was too late. Yeah. Boy, that happens to a lot of guys. That's why this game's so good. Yes, sir. Way back then. No, I think what we ought to do is increase. He's talking about the All-Star balloting. I think we ought to have the fans vote, and I think we ought to have the managers vote, and I think we ought to have the players vote, and then if they want to throw in a computer, let the computer vote too. You know, put all that stuff into the computer. Then we'll have more controversy, and it's good for the game. You know, I'll tell you one thing. If they're gonna talk about voting for the All-Star team, they better talk about those American League people voting. They ain't been voting too good lately about where them games been coming out. So, sure, there's some, you know, you can, I don't care who votes for them. You're going to always have this and that. But that's what makes the game. And sure, there's some injustices there. There's no doubt about that. But, you know, let's say if Rose was hitting 280. For one ball game, I want Rose playing for me. Right? For one ball, that's like Mays, that they vote Mays and Aaron in every year. For one game, I don't want Willie Mays and Hank Aaron. I don't care if they're hitting 220. I still want them. So, you know, it's like Johnny Bench and Ted Simmons. Well, I think Ted Simmons is the purest hitter I've ever seen. I played with Musial for years and years. Musial was a better hitter. But Ted Simmons gets better swings per time at bat than Musial got. If you can comprehend that. And Simmons is a much better hitter than Bench. But Johnny Bench will probably go into the Hall of Fame and will probably have all the offensive records of a catcher. A lot of them. So what's wrong with him being there for the last 7 years?
Okay.
There? A couple
while
more.
Back, Mike, you played baseball. Could you evaluate that in terms of a youngster?
Yeah, Little League baseball is great, but what I hate to see is too much organization. Give them a field, give them the equipment, and then just let them go out there and play. You know, you don't need any supervision. They don't need to be organized. Just give them the opportunity to play. And then throw it out there and say, we'll see in a couple hours. That's how you learn how to play. And if I was going to start, I'd play Nip Nother Nother's Brother, Rounds or whatever y'all call it. That's a great teacher of the game, I'll tell you why. Because in order to hit, which everybody wants to hit, right? You got to play every position. You start in right field, you go to center, left, then you come in third, strike, okay. So you learn how the game's played. And then when you get in the hit, if you keep getting hits, you keep getting the hitting, right? Okay? That's how the game. Take them out there and say, okay, line them up down in the corner and say the first guy in touches home plate, he's the first hitter and the second and so forth. And the little old fat kid that can't run winds up right field, right? So he's going to start from day one. He's got to figure something out. He says, look, I'm fat and I can't run like these skinny kids, right? So I got to be smarter or I got to be able to do something that they can't do. Okay? But if you take kids out there and you say, okay, now you're going to play for 3 innings and then this guy's going to play for 3 innings and you do this. My mommy says that, and hey, it's a competitive game. Just throw them out there. The good ones will come out. The bad ones won't play, and they won't play but one inning or get one swing with the bat. And if they want to quit, they'll quit and they won't come back. But if they got something inside, they'll come back fighting, and they'll figure a way out. And some of the great ball players of our time, the Stankies and the little guys, hey, they didn't have any talent, but they figured out something. They paid the price. What would they do? They started fights, they spiked guys, they did anything. They got their head beat in a lot, right? But they paid the price. They paid the price, and they deserved what they got. And that's the same thing, that's how I think. By the time these kids get to high school, they're so damn tired of playing ball, they don't want anything to do with it. My rule as a parent to my youngsters was this. They couldn't, you know, you have boundaries where the kids can't cross the streets, right? Well, all the ball fields and everything were outside of those boundaries, and the kids would come to me and they say, well, how are we going to play? I said, that's your problem. Well, yeah, but you won't drive me. How am I going to get there? I don't know. That's your problem. You make it tough for some kid to get something, I guarantee you he'll get it, if he wants it. If you hand it to him, like cake. Everybody likes chocolate cake and ice cream. Give it to him about 10 days in a row. See what he likes about it. Now, that's my own philosophies. Give him the opportunities. Give him the field and give him the equipment. And then give him the chance to fight, to get mad at each other, to find out how good they are, how good they're not. And you'll get better ball players. You get better people. And that's what's most important. You get better people. Bob.
I've talked to Ted Simmons, and he talks about Tiger Stadium, and he knows the difference between old ballparks and new. And he talks about Mickey Cochran, or Pete Rose has talked about when Jim Gillian was alive, how they got along well together because they were both switch hitters. But I think that most players don't really have a sense of that kind of thing. If Harvey Keene walked into the Cardinal clubhouse, 3/4 of those guys wouldn't even know who he was. They might know Willie Mays and Hank Aaron, but a guy who was a fairly significant guy and might be able to impart some knowledge to them, I don't think that the average player in 1979 would be as aware of that player as you would be at the start of your career and as anxious to get knowledge from him and learn something from him.
Yeah, it's the same old story. They're handed too much, too soon, too often. And they don't appreciate what, you know, they don't appreciate that they're dressing in Wrigley Field with Babe Ruth dressed. You understand? And the little fat kid that was running for nipping another another's brother, he appreciates it. He'd pay every blade of grass over there, man, because he's sure didn't want him, right? And maybe Joe Torre, who was a little fat kid when he was 15 and 16, and they made fun of him and this and that. We say kids are cruel, but kids aren't really cruel. When the little guy's overweight, and it's his fault for being overweight or somebody's fault, you know. Even if it's a medical problem or you can't afford it, whatever. You know, you say kids are cruel and you're going to take them away? No. I don't say, you know, if you're going to live with the, you know, if you're going to rise above the lines, you're going to have to fight them sooner or later. And if the kid's got something, you know, you say, well, I'm a little fat kid and I got gland trouble and I'm going to just go out and work and save enough money to like afford the operation, then I'll be able to go out there and back up with them kids and then race them again, right? Or run across the same. And I think it's the same way with the ball players today. You know, they play a year and a half in the minor leagues or 2 years and they're minor leagues, right? I think it's basically the same thing. And that's our society today. It's just, you know, if you thought 5 years ago you were going to drive in and pay a dollar and a quarter for gas, you'd say, you think, am I crazy? Not only will you pay the dollar and a quarter, you thank the damn guy when you leave because you got it, right? And all you have to do, if you want the gas to come down, is pay the price, right? All you got to do is pay the price. Just get all your friends together, say, we're not going to drive the car. We'll take the bus. But you're not willing to pay the price. You won't pay the price. You'd rather pay the buck and a quarter, right? And that's why they're going to charge a buck and a quarter for it. Same thing. See, that's the great thing about baseball. You ask me any question about any business, religion, life, your husband-wife relationship, I'll compare it to baseball, and I'll give you an example of it. And that's the kind of what I'd like to leave you with, that memory. It's a great game, great business, and I'm thankful to be part of it, and I thank you for your cooperation and kindness here today. Good luck.
Called him the Moon Man. Isn't he great? Great job, Mike. We certainly appreciate it. I want everybody to be sure to remain. We have a couple more important things, including Bob. I'd like you to stay just a moment. I know Mike Shannon has to get out to the ballpark. He has a pregame show. Mike Hadley has a business arrangement he has to attend to. Before they leave, we'd like to present each of them with a few booklets. One is from a place where I happen to be employed. Two others are publications of our association, Sabre. One is the last year's research journal. The new one is coming out in another month. The other book is This State in Baseball History. Mike, our pleasure to have you here. Thank you very much. Special guests here. Bob Costas, would you come up here? Bob Costas is the sports announcer for KMOX Radio. We're delighted to have him. He read about the meeting, talked to Bill Boris. We're delighted to have him here. Bob, you have a word or two for us?
Well, really, I'm not going to prolong this at all because I know that all of you are probably anxious to get out to the ballpark as quickly as you can, but I would just like to say that to me, the people in this room are the real baseball fans. I'm one of the younger people involved in sports broadcasting, not just in this town, but on any level. I do some work with CBS, and I like to think of myself when people ask me about myself in broadcasting. I think of myself kind of as a Mel Allen in a Jim Lampley world. And if you know what I mean by that, it seems like there's a lot of people who define sports sort of like, you know, how Guillermo Vias dresses this week at the French Open, or who won the celebrity battle of wet t-shirts. But to me, sports is people like you who actually realize that for some strange mystical reason, it makes a difference whether Harry Heilman hit 388 in 1923 or 382. For some reason, it does make a difference to all of us. I remember the first time that my father took me to Yankee Stadium. I was 7 years old. It was 1959. And he took me to Yankee Stadium to see the Yankees play the Orioles. And when I walked through those gates and I saw the field and I saw the green of the grass and the brown of the infield and of the warning track, I felt like Dorothy walking into the Emerald City at the Wizard of Oz. Because all I'd ever seen of baseball was on TV, and it was black and white, and everything was in gray, and all the colors jumped out at me. And you almost felt, and I've always felt since that day, you almost felt like you were in a place that you had to have a special regard for, and a regard for the history of, and for what went before, in some cases, in the best of ballparks, like Yankee Stadium, Wrigley Field, Fenway Park, like you were almost in a sacred place. And I think that people in this room have a proper appreciation of what baseball is and what it has meant, not just in the history of sports, but in a way in the fabric of the history of our country. So these are the real sports fans, and it's a delight to be with all of you. Thank you.
Another guest here had a moment on the floor a while ago, Flit Holliday. He had said he had told me he had something to say, but I believe you have covered it, have you, Flit? Your comments about Mike, those were what you wanted to speak about? All right, if you'll come up just a moment, we'll give Flit the floor for just a moment or two. He says he has something to say. Incidentally, he's a retired captain in the Air Force, and he ran against Jesse Owens a year or two ago.
Good evening. I'm very honored to have the opportunity to be here this afternoon. I'll tell you something briefly about my background as a youngster. I was born in the woods in a log cabin, and as I grew up, my people moved to California. And it happened at this particular time that they had a scout for the Yankee white team. So he said that Abenstein is the owner of the black Yankees and also the owner of the Harlem Globetrotters. And he said that we want you. And my mother said, why? See, we've heard so much about this boy. And it's a particular time I was going to high school before I went to college. And incidentally, they signed me up. And I finished high school, then I went to Tuskegee. I had the opportunity to run in the pin relay against Jesse Owens. Then from there, as a youngster, only just 21 years of age, I found myself playing in the Yankee Stadium in front of 50,000 people with the black Yankees. And this was one of the greatest thrills. But the greatest thrill is playing in the Negro League as one of the greatest white teams picked up of America, such as Dizzy Dean, Pepper Martin, Frankie Fish, and so forth. And I could go on and name several more. But incidentally, we started playing barnstorming in Chicago. We beat them in Chicago, I think it was 4-2. But the most thrill, when we played in Yankee Stadium, the home, the house, the roof built, in front of 70,000 people. And this was really a great deal. We had the great cycle piece started. And Dean wanted to jump on Pepper Martin because Josh Gibson hit a line drive, a single, and stole second. And then Cool Papa Bell come up, and he was out of sight. Dribbled to right, and when Pepper picked up the ball, I'm sliding home plate, no plate, whatever, because I could run, do 100 yards in 10 seconds. And I'm very glad to have the opportunity this evening, though I'm only 39, to see a different age, to see that what American sport can do to bring people together. And if we can do this in this country, this is one thing that we can do all over the world to bring people together. And I do have a grade from Tuskegee, and also I went to Stanford University. And thank God I've been able to live to see a new day, though I came out of the log cabin to see a new day, though I'm only 39. Good evening.
Thank you very much, Flit. Flit read about the meeting in the Post-Dispatch the other day and was so intrigued by the brief article that was included there about our organization that he decided to come today. just a couple quick points of business, and then we have some prizes to award, and we'll be on our way. Cappy Gagnon asked whether there was anybody who wanted to share a ride to the airport on Sunday. Cappy, if you'll stand up, if anybody is interested in sharing cabs to the airport, Cappy is right here. See Cappy after the program here. Work out the times, because the limousine service, I understand, is not quite as good as you might like it. The other thing, John Pardon inquired whether anybody was staying over until Monday. There may be some who would like to go out to the Sporting News who didn't have an opportunity to do so, or maybe do some exploring around the village. The village, see, I'm from Cooperstown, around the city of St. Louis. John Pardon is sitting right here. John's staying over. Anybody who's staying over, see John. If somebody would go downstairs, Craig, maybe you'd be kind enough. No, you can't go. Send somebody else. Tell the hotel people we'll be finished in about 5 or 10 minutes, and see if they can get that second elevator going, because, as you know, we've had a little bit of a problem here. Many of you will probably want to go upstairs to change around. I think it was pretty well agreed at our meeting this morning that we'd all try to go out together to the stadium together. If you want to get out early, fine, but we'll...